You gotta love computers. They get a mind of their own. You hit a button and it doesn't do what it's supposed to do all the time. So hey, take out your Bibles and turn to 2 Samuel chapter 6. We're not doing the whole book of Samuel. As the screen is indicating, we're gonna be on page 211 in the Pew Bible, 2 Samuel chapter 6. Well, today begins a new installment in our Believe series. For the last 10 weeks, we have been talking about kind of the things that we believe. We've been talking about our head knowledge and the things that go in our heads, and we've been asking the question, what do I believe? What should I believe? How should I believe? What did Jesus believe? And we've been asking those questions, and today we begin the next section of our Believe series, where we take the 12-inch trip from our brains down to our hearts, and we begin asking the question, what should I do? You see, when you take head knowledge and you marry it with what's going on in the heart, it begins to come out in the way that we live, in the way that we act, in the way that we behave. And the first place that we're going to go is with this concept of worship. Now, this word worship is a very loaded question. If I were to survey this room, if I were to ask each person in here this morning, I would get a plethora of different answers, because worship in a lot of ways is very personal. In a lot of ways, we connect with God in worship in different ways. Some of you might define worship as what we do here on Sunday mornings when we come together in this space. Some of you would define worship maybe as singing. Others, you would say partaking of the Lord's Supper is worship. Some might even say what you're doing right now, listening to a sermon, is worship. Some might define worship in the ways that we worship: standing up, sitting down, kneeling, arms raised outwards, are the types of songs that we sing. Hymns versus chorus versus praise versus contemporary songs. Songs that are sung to God and songs that are sung about God. Some might define worship as prayer or as a lifestyle or by sharing the gospel. The answers that people would give could and would be all over the map. And for the most part, they'd all be correct. Worship appears in many different forms, and it is engaged in by people with many different emotions. In fact, the single act of raising hands in response in worship comes with its own varieties, as comedian Tim Hawkins is going to point out in this little video clip. Watch this. I absolutely love that. You know, worship can be all over the place because worship is very personal. It has so many different meanings. So today, what I don't want to do is define worship. I don't want to define a particular way to worship. I don't want to pigeonhole us into one form of worship. But I do want to talk about the why behind worship. And to do so, I want to ask our key question for this week. How do I honor God in the way that he deserves? Church, this is really what worship is, isn't it? It is determining how we can best honor God in the way he deserves. Now, our modern word of worship, our modern English word, finds its etymology in the old English word worship, which means the condition of being worthy. It's the idea of showing a deity, a lord, or someone of distinction their worth and value to your life. When we worship, since we know the one true God, we are taking the opportunity to tell God, you are important to me. God, you give me purpose. You've rescued me from my sin. And God, I am grateful for that. God, you have value to me. King David recognized this need that we have to worship God, to honor him in the way he deserves. He writes in Psalm 95, it's part of our key verse for today, come, let us sing to the Lord. Let us shout aloud to the rock of our salvation. Let us come before him with thanksgiving and extol him with music and song. For the Lord is the great God, the great King above all gods. In his hand are the depth of the earth, and the mountain peaks belong to him. The sea is his, for he has made it, and his hand forms the dry land. Come, let us bow down in worship. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture, the flock under his care. You know, David recognized that God is worthy of our honor, that God deserves our worship. In fact, that's our key idea for today. I worship God for who he is and what he has done for me. Now, in that psalm, David highlighted a few ways to worship. He talked about singing for joy and shouting aloud and offering music and song and bowing down before God and kneeling before him. In one passage of scripture that we just read, David highlighted five different ways that we can worship. And what's important is, the reason for it is much more important. David transitioned in verse number 3 with the word for. And that three-letter word is a pretty big deal because it means there is a reason why we worship. And the reason is because of what God has done. When we worship, we are showing God his worth and his value in our lives. When we worship, we are declaring who he is to us. That's what David did. He called God the rock of salvation. Great God, great King above all gods. He holds the depths of the earth in his hands and the mountain peaks. The seas are in his and his they are his creation. He's our maker and he cares for us, his flock. Church, that's what worship is. It's simply defining who God is. It is declaring his value in our life. So if I believe this, and I do, how should that knowledge change me once it makes that 12-inch trip from my brain down to my heart? What should I do? How should my worship look? Well, first, I should remember worship is about an audience of one. You know, if we are going to worship, if we are going to give God his honor that he deserves, we have to remember, worship isn't about me. Worship isn't about the people sitting around me when I'm in corporate worship. Worship isn't about what people are going to think about my actions or think about what I do. They're not going to look at me and say, well, that's not worship, that's worship, that's not worship. And when we begin to think like that, we have forgotten who our audience is. Worship is about God. It is an outpouring of the heart between me, myself, and God. And no one else. And that's something that King David understood. And it's exemplified in an event from his life in 2 Samuel chapter 6. Now, we've got to set the stage for what's going on here in 2 Samuel. David has just become the king of Israel. If you remember your history, you will remember that David was anointed the king of Israel by King Saul, or by the prophet Samuel, but King Saul was already on the throne. And for the last 10 plus years, David has been waiting on this day. Finally, Saul has died, and David is now king. And as king, his first order of business was establishing his capital city. And so he takes his armies, and he goes into the Jebusite city of Jerusalem, where they conquer the city, and he sets up his kingdom and his capital there in Jerusalem. And he recognizes pretty quickly, you know, this doesn't only need to be the political capital, this needs to be the spiritual capital of our nation as well. And so he says, it's time to bring God home. Now, that's a weird thing for us because we think of God as omniscient, omnipresent. We think of God being everywhere all the time, and God has always been that way. But in Israel, since the time he brought them out of Egypt into the wilderness, God had resided amongst them in the tabernacle and taking up residence there in the Holy of Holies, represented by the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark of the Lord, as it's called in multiple places throughout the scripture. The Ark of the Lord was a box that was made by the craftsmen there in the wilderness. And when they would move, they would pull the Ark of the Covenant out of the tabernacle, and they'd move the tabernacle. They'd set the tabernacle up, they'd put it in there, and God would take up residence. It was a physical representation of God. When they would go into battle, they would pray, they would seek God's leadership, God's wisdom. And when they would go into battle, God would lead them by the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant into the battle before the armies. It was an important part of their history. But in the last days of the judges, in the days before Saul, in the days before King David, they were in a spiritually low point in their history. The priests were not doing their jobs. In fact, the high priest was Eli, and his sons were Hophni and Phinehas. And these two sons, they were not very good as priests. They were wicked, they were cruel, they were lazy. In fact, they would go and they would take their portion of the priest's food and sacrifices long before they were supposed to, long before the people offered them up. They would go and just rob it right out of their cauldrons as they were cooking this meat. And then one day, they're going into battle against the Philistines. Hophni and Phinehas, they're leading the charge, and they're not really in a position to be patient, to wait on God and his leadership and his guidance. And so they take the Ark of the Covenant, and they carry it into battle against the Philistines. And that day, both Hophni and Phinehas are killed because they are being disobedient to God, and the Philistines steal God. Isn't that crazy to think that God could be stolen? But that day, God was stolen. The Philistines take it back into their villages. Well, news comes back to Eli, the old priest. He's sitting on a stump. He's blind. He's a very large man. They tell him that his sons have both been killed and that the Ark of the Covenant has been stolen. And in shock, he falls backwards off the stump and he breaks his neck. For the first time in their history, they have no spiritual leadership in place. They don't know exactly what to do. Meanwhile, the Ark of the Covenant is over in Philistine territory. They take it into their temple built to the god Dagon. And overnight, as they leave the Ark of the Covenant in the temple to Dagon, the statue in the temple of Dagon falls forward. They come in the next morning, and there is the god of the Philistines, Dagon, bowing down to the one true God. I love this story. He is there bowing down to the one true God. So they stand Dagon back up. They go on throughout their day. God begins to inflict panic within the people. He begins to inflict tumors all over their body. They go to bed. They get up the next morning. Here is Dagon once again bowing down to the Ark of the Covenant, to the representation of God. This time, though, his head has fallen off, his hands have fallen off, and they are sitting at the threshold, at the doorway to the temple to Dagon. So they kind of get scared, and the Philistine says, you know, we probably need to get this thing out of here. So they ship it on down the road to another Philistine town. And this other Philistine town suddenly begins to rupture into a panic. They, too, begin to break out with tumors all over their body. And they say, we got to get this out of here. So they try to send it down the road once again. And as they send it down the road once again, they said, no, don't bring that thing here. We want nothing to do with this box. This is Israel's God, and we don't want him coming near us. And so they take some oxen that have never pulled anything, and they take a new cart, and they blind the oxen, and they put it on the cart, and they send it on its way, and it goes right back into Israelite territory. But here's the problem. They're not worshiping God well. They're not following God well in Israel these days. They don't have any spiritual leadership. I mean, Samuel's going to come along eventually. He's a little young, and eventually he's going to bring them to a great spiritual place. But right now, they don't know what to do with it. So they grab a couple of Levites, people who the priests come from, people who are over the law and making sure they're following the law, and they say, hey, why don't you guys watch this? We're not going to bring it back to the tabernacle. We're just going to kind of put it in a back room, in a back storage lot, and just kind of let it sit there. You guys make sure that nothing happens to it. Fast forward some 80 years. David is now the king, and he's now made Jerusalem his capital city. And he says, you know what? We need to get God back into our nation. We need to bring God back. And so they go after God. It's still a weird concept, isn't it, that they are going after God? But they are. They're going to get the Ark of the Covenant. And this is where David makes his big mistake. You see, David doesn't go to the priest. He doesn't go to the Levites. He doesn't go to those who know the law really well and ask them, hey, can you bring this back? No, he gets a military contingent together, some 30,000 men, and they go down to the location where the Ark of the Covenant's at. They get it, they put it on a brand new cart, and they begin to move it. You see, they're not doing it the way God had told them to do it. And there is a Levite named Uzzah who is walking beside this. He's been caring for the Ark of the Covenant for some time, and because they're not following God's commands, they're not walking with God in the way they should be walking with God, the oxen stumble, the cart begins to tip, and the Ark of the Covenant begins to fall off, and Uzzah reacts in a matter of seconds, and he reaches his hand up, and he steadies the Ark, and as he does, he dies. A lot of people get to that and they say, well, why in the world would God have such a problem with Uzzah doing this? Why would he have a problem with him reaching it out? I mean, we know this is God. No one's supposed to touch it, but all he was doing was steadying it. Why would God have a problem? And the problem is their worship was all wrong. Their worship had gotten out of whack, and they were no longer walking with God. They were no longer worshiping God in the way that they were supposed to be worshiping. And this is kind of the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back. If anyone in that party should have known what to do, it would have been Uzzah. Well, David watches what happens that day, and he sees the power and the might of God, and he gets scared, and he gets angry, and he says, get rid of that thing. Put it away. We do not need that power with us right now. And so they go on their way. And they leave the Ark of the Covenant behind at the house of a man named Obed-Edom. But God's not done with David, and God's not done with Israel. And he begins to bless the house of Obed-Edom. And news makes its way back to David that God is blessing Obed-Edom and his household. And David says, okay, there is something there. There is a power, there's a might, and we need that in our kingdom. We need to worship correctly. And this time, David mixes it up. This time, David goes to the Levites. He goes to the priests. He says, hey, could you guys tell us what we're supposed to do? And so they tell him what they're supposed to do, and they get together, and they send priests down this time instead of the armies to go and retrieve the Ark of the Covenant. Grab your Bible, 2 Samuel chapter 6. We're going to pick up the story in verse number 13. When those who were carrying the Ark of the Lord had taken six steps, he sacrificed a bull and a fattened calf. David, wearing a linen ephod, danced before the Lord with all his might, while he and the entire household of Israel brought up the Ark of the Lord with loud shouts and the sounds of trumpets. David sends the priests down to the house of Obed-Edom, and this time they collect the ark. This time it's priests taking poles and putting it through the rings on the ark and picking it up and carrying it back to Jerusalem. No carts involved. They're doing it the way that God prescribed way back in the law. This time, after seeing what had happened, they didn't know how things were going to go. And after David and the group took six paces, six short steps, David halted them. It's enough to walk across this stage. He stopped them, and he said, it's time to worship. It's time to sacrifice. And they took a fattened calf and a bull, and they offered a celebration, a worship, an offering to God to thank him for delivering them in that moment, for providing them the way to bring the ark back. After the sacrifice, they continued on their journey, and David led the way, jumping and shouting and singing. Music was playing all around. And it's in this moment that David begins to disrobe. You see, David would have went there in his kingly robe. It would have been ornate. It would have been decorated. It would have been heavy. It would have been large. And it would have been cumbersome. And so he removes this, and there he is in his linen ephod. Now, a linen ephod is a short, sleeveless undergarment that they would often wear. You could probably compare it to, you know, some boxer shorts and a white t-shirt today, but it's what David was wearing. It certainly wasn't immodest, but it wasn't the thing you normally saw the king wearing when he was out in public, especially in an environment of worship. They come into the city, and as they're celebrating, as David is dancing and singing and praising and worshiping unhindered, his wife is watching the celebration enter the city. Look at verse number 16. As the ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, Michal, daughter of Saul, watched from a window. And when she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. David was embarrassing her. She couldn't believe the way the king of Israel was dancing before these people, the way he was carrying on, especially having disrobed, having come out in only a linen ephod. Spouses, you ever been that way? You ever watched your spouse do something that you're sitting there shaking your head like, I cannot believe that they are doing that, and you just feel embarrassed, and you want them to know? You want to make sure that they understand. Well, that's exactly what played out. Maybe you've been on the other end. You've done something. You've been really excited, and your spouse has caught you, and they've let you know, and that high that you were on all of a sudden is cut down to here as soon as you come home. Well, that's what happens. Look at verse number 20. When David returned home to bless his household, Michal, daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, and listen to the sarcasm, and listen to the disgust in her voice, how the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, disrobing in the sight of slave girls, of his servants, as any vulgar fellow would. She could not believe that the king of Israel would dance and parade around just like any vulgar fellow in front of these slave girls, in front of these peasants, in front of the common man. She was disgusted. But David knew who he was dancing before. He knew what his actions meant. Look at verse number 21. David said to Michal, it was before the Lord who chose me rather than your father or anyone from his house when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people. Israel. I will celebrate before the Lord. I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated in my own eyes. But by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in honor. Michael's disgusted. She can't believe her husband would dance that way in the streets. And he reminded her, "Hun, it wasn't before you that I was dancing. It wasn't before these slave girls. It wasn't before these peasants that I was dancing. It was an audience of one. It was God that I was worshiping. And remember, hun, God chose me. It wasn't your dad who made me king. It wasn't the people who'd made me king. It was God. God sent Samuel to Jesse's house, David's dad's, and it was God that says, none of these other brothers are the one. It's the one out in the field, and they anointed him there that day. God's the one that made him king, and it was God that David was dancing before, that David was worshiping, that David was celebrating. And he says, oh, by the way, to worship my God, if it takes me becoming even more undignified than I was just then, I'm willing to do it. If it takes more for me to worship God, I will do what it takes. Because he was all interested in authentic worship. Church, let me ask you, what keeps you from worshiping God fully unhindered? When you're in corporate worship, when you're here with other Christians, what keeps you from worshiping God? Are you worried about the way your voice is going to sound or what someone might think of you when you worship? You know, worship isn't just singing. We know that. Worship is so much more. It might be the way that you carry yourself. It might be the way you respond to God's grace. It might be the way you respond when things don't go well, when surprises happen in your life. It might be in the way that you act around other people. You might hear that off-color joke. And worship is not joining in. Worship is honoring God in that moment. But do you joke so others won't think you approve? What is it that keeps you from worshiping God fully unhindered? Church, I know there are many things that oftentimes hold us back. But we can learn from David. Worship should be for our audience of one, not for others. Now, David also teaches us another aspect of what we should do. Worship is not passive, it is participative. You know, David was not a priest. David was not a Levite. David was from the tribe of Judah. It was the priest, it was the Levites who were in charge of the worship. It was the priest and the Levites who were to set the spiritual tone for the nation of Israel. David could have easily said, you know, I think we need God back. I think we need the Ark of the Covenant back in our possession, back in the central place in its worship here in the nation of Israel. Why don't you guys go get it? Why don't you guys go organize this and bring it back? David didn't do any of that. He was the one that was leading the charge. He didn't just sit back and watch. He led the way. Worship isn't passive. It is something we let, it's not something that we let our preachers and our elders and our priests or leaders do on our behalf. Worship is something that we all do. David's the one who went down and he brought the ark up. David's the one who directed the priests who had taken only six steps to stop and say, hey, we got to thank God. We have to worship God in this moment. David is the one who danced unhindered in the streets. David is the one who set the environment for that day. Church, worship isn't something that someone else can do for you. It is something only you can participate in for yourself before your audience of one. Now, when we read this story, it's easy to see the emotion and the feeling of that day. I love emotional worship services. There are a handful of worship experiences that I have been in that I can look back now 10, 15, 20 years later and think, man, that was powerful. There was something there that day, and I live for those kind of worship environments and experiences. I would have loved to have been there in Jerusalem that day to experience the energy and the emotion of that day. But I'm not convinced that the energy and the emotion of the day was what was driving David. In this story, he teaches us a third practice. Worship is not just a feeling, it's a decision. Bringing the ark to Jerusalem was a decision that he made. He had made Jerusalem his capital, and he knew that God's physical presence needed to be there, so he brought God to Jerusalem. The first time that David tried to bring the ark to the city, David was working off of emotion and feeling. His emotions drove him to make moves in haste, to carry out the travel without consulting God and his word. But the second time, David said, you emotions, you get behind me. Let's think this thing through. And so he called up the priest and he says, look, I want to get the Ark of the Covenant back. How do we need to go about that? And they said, well, you need to carry the Ark and the priests need to be the one to do that. And it's recorded for us what they did in 1 Chronicles chapter 15. This time David organized the movement of the ark. He had 862 priests there, along with religious leaders, people assigned to play music along the way, seven bulls and seven rams ready to go to be sacrificed to God. In this movement of the ark, David removed the feeling from the equation, and he proceeded with success because of one decision after another. Now, that's the beauty of worship that is planned and organized. Planned and organized worship doesn't mean that that emotion and feeling is completely removed. Because after all, they organized it, they planned it, and that freed David up to be unhindered in his worship. Now, there's one final thing that David teaches us. Worship is not simply a mood, it's a response. Now, emotion is a part of worship. You cannot completely divorce worship and emotion and say, okay, it's all got to be organized, it's all got to be planned, because there is absolutely emotion. But along with emotion, along with mood, along with feeling, comes a response. You know, David was responding that day to God providing them success. Let me ask you, when you worship, what are you responding to? Let's just stay in here and let's talk corporate worship. When you come to church on Sunday mornings and you stand before God, when you worship, what's going through your minds? Now, I know not everyone sings. There are people in here that it's not because of their voice. It's not because of you're worried about what others are going to think. You just don't like to sing. When I came to Westside, I quickly realized that this was a movement church. You know, along the way over the years at camp, sign language had been taught with a lot of the songs. And, you know, Lord, I lift your name on high. He came from heaven to earth to show the way. You know, we do the motions. I'm not good with any of that. I have realized a long time ago that typically that's one song I can actually do the motions on. But typically I can't sing and do motions. My hand and my mouth do not coordinate that way. And so I can either do the motions or I can either sing. I prefer to sing, and so I like to sing. So I realize for everyone that singing's not your thing. But let me ask you, when you're standing there, and if you're singing or if you're not, when you are standing before God in worship, what's going through your mind? Is it what's happening later in the day? Or is it what God has done for you? The salvation that he's given you? Maybe the raise you got at work? Maybe the news you got from the doctor? What is it that is going through your mind when you worship? That whole day, David was responding to what God was doing. Oh yeah, there was emotion, there was feeling, because it was planned and there could be emotion, there could be feeling, there could be a mood, but it was in response to what God was doing. So let me ask you, when you stand before God in worship, whether it's here in corporate worship or it's elsewhere in worship, what is it that you are responding to? Perhaps that's one simple mind shift you can make. Or maybe you're ready to respond in worship. Maybe you're ready to experience that in a new way, in a different way, but yet you have yet to respond to the call of Jesus to be your Lord, Master, and Savior, and you're ready to respond today. Maybe this morning you're already an immersed believer. You're ready to get busy serving alongside of us, making Westside your church home. Or maybe this morning you're hurting and want your church family to lift you up to pray for you. If you have one of those decisions to make, we invite you to come as we stand and sing our song of invitation.